Introducing Finally, a new energy-efficient light bulb that reveals beauty in your home. Colors are true and natural, never washed out. It'd be extraordinary if you could see this light. But this is radio. What a pity. A light this stunning deserves better. I deserve better. Finally, you'll love your light. Maybe a little too much. Available at Costco.
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it?
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't?
Who are the unstoppable ones?
Is it just that they can do it and I can't? Mission unstoppable. Mission unstoppable.
The unstoppable ones.
You did say unstoppable, right? You did say unstoppable, right? What is it they know that I don't? Coach Frankie Picasso takes you on Mission Unstoppable. Can anyone stop these people?
Good evening. I am the unstoppable Frankie Picasso, and tonight you are about to go on another Mission Unstoppable. My guest this evening has courageously been shining a spotlight on what some might call the dirty laundry of her life. But rather than this being an act of negativity and self-pity, it is a powerful and inspirational act for a woman who has become a beacon of hope for other victims of childhood trauma and abuse. Stay tuned and stay close to see what this self-proclaimed hopeologist has to say about a future filled with joy, love, and realized dreams. I can guarantee you this is going to be a powerful show. Again, this is the Unstoppable Frankie Picasso, and the time is now 8 p.m. in Cambridge, Ontario, 7 in Chicago, and 5 in Los Angeles. And if you are listening to us on Tuesday, December the 7th, then you have tuned into the live version of the show, and we welcome your participation. You can join me on air by calling 646-595-3741 or joining me in the chat room, which is now open. And if you're listening to the archive version, thank you for downloading it, and feel free to contact me if you need or want more information at frankie@missionunstoppable.com. Again, thanks go out to Blog Talk Radio and TogiNet Radio for broadcasting this show over their networks. It seems strange to have baked Christmas cookies all day and then become a host of a show about childhood trauma and abuse. But here we are. My guest this evening is Deirdre Huey, a woman who I described just moments ago as a woman of great courage. Now, years ago, Deirdre survived sexual abuse, parental neglect, and rape. And these events and others caused her to commit herself to a psychiatric institution at the age of 16, being diagnosed with bipolar depression and a borderline personality disorder with suicidal tendencies. Sounds pretty scary. Over the next 10 years, Deirdre abused drugs and alcohol, as she truly believed that success and happiness weren't in the cards for her. Now, today, she's a self-described hopeologist, an inspirational speaker, host of her own radio show, Three Steps Forward, a recognized expert on Love Your Life Again, author of I Am Bound and Determined, and maybe most importantly, she is a loving wife and mother. How did she go from nowhere to having all her dreams come true? Well, let's welcome Deirdre to Mission Unstoppable Radio. Good evening.
Hi, Frankie. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you. A little tired after baking all those cookies all day.
Yeah, no, what kind of cookies were you baking?
Oh, gosh. You know what? There's like five or six different kinds. There were thumbprints and brown sugar ones and ones with the Dolce de Leche in them. It was just amazing ones, shortbreads. And just, you know, all day. And I said to myself, I feel like a truck just ran over me as I was standing there doing it. But it's, you know, it's good to do it. And I wanted to give, you know, give them out as gifts. So it's nice. Nice to get a little homemade gift. Yeah.
Always
but
nice.
We're here to talk about you. So let's talk about you. You know, I mentioned your book, I Am Bound and Determined. And as you know, I think that it is absolutely an amazing book. But
thank you.
You mentioned in your book that that the traumas that people survive are not the most tragic part. It's what you do inside your head long after the abuse has ended, which is really the trauma, I guess, or traumatic. But what is it? What are some of the, you know, the after effects of childhood trauma? And let's start there. Let's start with, you know, some of the effects, and then let's talk about your effects, how it affected you.
Sure. Well, the after effects, you know, what goes on inside your head is so debilitating because the trauma, you know, it's different than a trial and tribulation because a trial and tribulation, it's short. It's over. Mm-hmm. You know, you may be grieved about it for a little while, but it's gone. Trauma goes on for so long because it has so many emotional repercussions, and there's so much damage in your head. You can think you can lose all of your self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
You can abuse drugs. A lot of people that have childhood trauma end up abusing drugs. Sexual promiscuity because there's such a low self-worth, and they don't know anything different because of the abuse that they have encountered.
Right.
There can be alcohol abuse, horrible relationships because they have no idea how to have a normal relationship with somebody. So the effects can be long-lasting. Some people can't hold down jobs.
Wow. It really is disempowering.
Absolutely.
Disempowering to
them.
Yeah.
That's
pretty horrific. Yeah. For yourself, a survivor and a thriver,
mm-hmm.
let me add, how did it affect you? And when was your earliest recognition, let's say, that you're being traumatized?
My earliest recollection was probably not until I was in the middle of the sexual abuse and was walking down the street, and the guy that was abusing me came up to me and was yelling at me because I had walked by a police station, and he didn't see me until after I'd gone by the police station and started yelling at me because he thought I had gone to the police and told them what was happening. And it wasn't until that moment that I realized that there was something horribly wrong. But I think you kind of have to step back from that. And the reason I didn't even recognize that is because of a lack of communication and love in my house. And so I didn't really have a great sense of self-worth to begin with. So the sexual abuse was allowed to happen for so much longer than it probably would have otherwise.
How old were you on that occasion?
I was 12.
You were 12. And when the sexual abuse was happening to you, did it feel... I mean, your parents, in some respects, had abandoned you in
yeah.
that you didn't live at home during the week. They asked other people to look after you. So did the sexual abuse feel like love to you? Did it feel like, or
you know,
did it feel like...
You know, there were parts of it that felt really great. I mean, and people don't want to talk about that, but there were parts of it for me at the age of 12 and not feeling a lot of love and comfort at home. It felt awesome to have somebody hold me. To have
mm-hmm.
somebody hold me was wonderful. It was a very comforting feeling. Now, the abuse that happened afterwards and, you know, above and beyond the holding and being threatened to be killed, there were several times when he threatened to kill me holding a 2x4 over my head. That part was terrifying. But in the beginning, being held overwhelmed any fear that I had, and it wasn't
how
until
old
as
was
it
he?
Progressed that the fear increased. I'm sorry?
How old was he?
He was 18.
And was he a family member?
No, he was not. He was somebody in the city.
Okay.
In the town that I grew up in. Well, not a city, in the town that I grew up in. And they believe I was one of his earliest victims because later on, he was incarcerated or imprisoned for raping women at gun and knife point.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. So some of the words that you use around these victims that, you know, of trauma, shame and guilt and fear. But the other thing that you say needs to happen is forgiveness.
Yeah.
And as you read your story and I hear your story and I read about the stories of the other women in your book, that seems like a lot to ask. You know, talking about people who've overcome physical abuse, emotional abuse, death, abandonment, rape, anxiety attacks, rejection, foster homes, you know, poverty, pain, drugs, loss. I mean, just so much terror, just so much happening in their life. How can we ask them to forgive? Is it forgive themselves?
I think the most important thing to realize is that exactly what you just said, Frankie, is that you have to forgive yourself. What happens is that somebody who's been traumatized, especially at an early age, it doesn't matter. They're not thinking with the mind of an adult. They're thinking with the mind of a kid. And as a kid, we think we have so much power and so much control. We really do. And our imagination could go away with, run away with us. And we think that we should have or could have stopped something from happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so we end up blaming ourselves. And we blame ourselves for things that we allowed to have happen. And so many people do that. And so the first thing you have to do is to forgive yourself. Forgive yourself. And I can remember the first time I realized that this was something I needed to do for myself, which was when I was in my early 20s. And I had gone over to a friend's house who had children. And I stayed away from children. I hadn't been around children in years. And I walked into her house, never met her children before, and she had two 11-year-old, they were twins, two 11-year-old girls. And when I walked in and saw how young these 11-year-old girls were and how innocent and sweet and beautiful, and it jumped into my, I actually sat down and started crying because all of a sudden the thought that jumped into my head was, wow. That happened to me, not because of me.
Right. And not only that, I wonder if you look at them and thought, wow, that should have been me.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. But that's not the first thing that jumped into my head.
Yeah.
But as I saw
how young
that,
they are,
as I saw how young they were and how vulnerable and that somebody took advantage of me in that state.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I looked at it that way. And it was the first time that I allowed myself to begin to forgive me. Because I
yeah.
took so much of that responsibility on myself. I should have, I could have, I would have, you know, all of that shame that's built into it. When really there is no shame in it. It happened.
No.
And I need to forgive myself and move on. And so that's what I mean when I'm talking about forgiving. That's the first step because you can't forgive anybody else until you start forgiving.
No, and it seems so unfair that so many victims, the blame goes to the wrong party, that it goes to themselves rather than the instigators.
Well, I think
and really
so
children don't have power.
Yeah, and there's so much, we don't talk about this. We don't talk about, and it was terrifying for me the first time I told this story. I was terrified thinking that I was going to share it. And it wasn't for any other reason than we don't hear about it. People don't stand up and say, hey, yeah, I was abused when I was a kid. I mean, we're told as we're growing up, you can't talk about this. And you're shamed into you can't talk about this.
It's embarrassing.
And yeah, it's going to be embarrassing for you. It's embarrassing for other people. When really, if we talk about it and get it out in the open, maybe it would happen a lot less frequently.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was interesting. I was at a baptism on Sunday, and it was in a church that I don't attend church, but it was in a church, a Lutheran church, and they were talking about that they were doing this because of the sins of this child, you know, the sins that she had come into this world with. And you're looking at this, you know, 8-week-old baby and going, what sins? What are you talking about? And I think it's kind of like this kind of mentality that also allows this, you know, allows for the fear and the not talking and let's just, you know, hide this because it's shameful. And in your book, I Am Bound and Determined, you mentioned at the beginning that it might be a difficult read for some people because it's a lot of abuse and hardship and terror and horrible and horrific things happening to people. In this book, real life people, women who had to go through these events, you know, oftentimes by themselves, that if we talked about it, as you're doing and they're doing, it does allow for the conversation to be easier.
Sure.
To breathe.
And I also wanted to make sure that the book wasn't just about that it wasn't just about these traumas, but it was about my goal truly was to help this to be a book of hope, that somebody would be able to pick up this book and grab on to one of the stories of some woman because it reminds them of themselves, and steps through how they all became successful. Because you had, in the only way you could get into this book was to have had a trauma, but also to have overcome it and to have become successful, whatever success means for you. So there's a lot of hope in the book, too. But you're right, that some of the stories are really hard. And the only reason I was able to read them when I got them, when I got all of the interviews back and put them together, was I knew that all of these women ended up okay. Because they were. They were difficult for me to read, and I did the interviews.
You know what I loved about it? I loved that the part where you say in the book that you cannot compare their traumas. You can't say that, you know, this rape was worse than that rejection or this whatever. It's because for the individual, you know, on that scale of 1 to 10, they could both be a 10, you know, of terror or whatever. And I think that's really important that, you know, I underwent, you know, a different kind of trauma, but being in the hospital for 5.5 months and being with people and seeing what they go through, you know, I might say, well, gee, that's just a hangnail. But to that person, it was as traumatic
Everything.
As my injuries were, you know? So you can't compare.
No,
but you can,
and it's not meant to be aware to do that at all. I don't want somebody to pick this up and say, well, this can't, you know, this can't help me because my traumas aren't like those traumas. Or, you know, I thought my trauma was bad until I read so-and-so's story. Well, it just doesn't, like you said, it just doesn't matter because everybody comes from their own perspective. So the worst thing that's happened to me is the worst thing that's happened to me. And the worst thing that's happened to you is the worst thing that's happened to you. No one from the outside can say, well, Frankie's is so much worse than Deidre's.
Right.
They can't say that because each of us has our own worst and best stories. And for us, that's what we're basing everything else on.
So given that theory, let's just take that one step further. Each of us has a story. Everyone has a story.
Absolutely.
And being, you know, the worst thing that ever happened to you, story, if all of these people have really bad stories, how is it that they managed to survive when others didn't? What was the secret ingredient? What was the what was inside them? Because I asked this question too. You know, I asked. So what did you come to the conclusion, if you have any, of why they were successful?
Well, it's interesting because I asked each of them, each person that's in the book, I asked them what the turning point was for them.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think that that's such a huge piece of why they were able to go forward. I mean, where did that hope come back in? Because that's what I think happens, is that when you've been traumatized, whatever your trauma is you lose hope.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how traumatic it was for you, depends on how much hope you lose. But if you lose so much hope that you're suicidal, which most of the, or a majority of the women in this book got to that point where they were suicidal, just were done with life. So what happens is somewhere along the way you have to get hope back, because otherwise you can't move forward. So for each one of the women in the book, there was some person that helped them. Now, it could come in different ways. Some people, it was a physical person that talked with them. For me, it was a therapist. Her name was Dr. Carol Hertz. Changed my life. I remember a very significant point in time where I gained back hope in a conversation with her. For someone else, Dr. Nancy Irwin, it was a discussion with a, I believe it was a coach, where she had a conversation with her coach, and her coach gave her inspiration to move forward and got hope back. It's in most cases, it was a physical person talking with them that gave them hope. In other cases, it was a seminar. I know there was one lady in the book. I can't think of her name at the moment. But it was a seminar that she went to by Zig Ziglar. And it was his words that gave her hope again. So I believe one woman, it was religion. But it's still, there was some other person, whether it was a book that somebody wrote and they read this book and it inspired them, or the physical person in person. I think actually majority of the women, it was somebody in their life that spoke to them and cared about them and helped to give them hope again.
So do you think the I mean, I'm sure they had lots of people talking to them at some point in their life and that they may have turned away from or said they could never understand me or I'm different. So do you think that it was the fact that somebody, they felt that somebody cared?
Yeah, oh yeah, I think that has to happen. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I know for me, and my parents and I have really good relationships now. My father's passed away, but my mom and I have a really good relationship now. But that took years of recovery, just absolute years of recovery. And I know there were other people in my life that cared about me, but I didn't feel it. Like you said,
mm-hmm.
I didn't feel it. And it wasn't until a moment, actually, when I was in the psychiatric institution that my doctor came to visit me, and we were standing outside talking, and I had this overwhelming feeling. It wasn't something that she said, but I had this overwhelming feeling from her and a sense from her that she saw herself in me, that she
mm-hmm.
saw greatness for me. And at that moment, I thought to myself, if this woman can see greatness in me, this person that I mm-hmm. admire and respect, then you know what? I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. It may take a long time, but I'm going to be okay. At that moment, I had hope for my future.
Can I ask you about your parents, your mom?
Sure.
Now that you say that you have a wonderful relationship with them, did you walk with them through all of the things that happened to you, and did you ask her what was going on with her at the time and why she couldn't give you,
you know,
what a child might
have
needed?
It's actually really interesting because we didn't have this conversation until rather recently. And we had tried on several occasions to have that discussion, but it was, I don't think either one of us was really ready because it was very accusatory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you weren't and you didn't, that kind of thing. And I think it's taken until this point that I was able to hear what she had to say, and she was able, without feeling overwhelming guilt, to hear what I had to say too. So it both back and forth. So I could hear her and she could hear me. And she told me a bunch of things that she actually did do. But what's interesting is that she never told me. We did not have the conversations that needed to happen so that I knew that she was caring about and doing things on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually asked her, and this just happened a couple of weeks ago when I was in Massachusetts with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sitting down having dinner, and she said, you know, I have some problems with your book, because she read the book.
Okay.
She says, I have some problems with your book. And I said, okay, let's talk about them. She says, well, I just don't agree with some of the things that are in your book. And I said, okay, well, let's talk about them. So,
yeah.
You know, she said, you know, you make me come out across as this callous, uncaring person. And I said, well, I don't think you are now. And she says, yes, but you made me look like that when you were growing up. And I said, but that's how you came across to me. That's my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, I did all these things. And she explained all the different things that she did. And when she said them, I mean, it was obviously they were true,
mm-hmm.
just from what she was saying. And I know that what she was saying was true. And I looked at her and I said, I really appreciate you telling me. I said, but how was I supposed to know?
So what did she do? She tried to get you out of the house so that something else wouldn't happen to you? Was that the reason? Or
No, what I'm saying is that she, the different types of things that she did was she was in constant contact with the therapist. She was in constant contact with the hospital when I got admitted to the hospital. There were all of these things that she did, but she never let
me
know. We didn't have any conversations.
And the therapist never let you know it?
No, and the therapist didn't let me know.
Hmm. Interesting. It must be difficult for her, and I can appreciate that. And I know
and
for
I
myself.
Can too, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, as an adult and a mother, you know, our parents, it's so easy to blame our parents for so many things. But,
oh, my God.
But I remember, you know, not having the best relationship with my own mother. But coming to terms and understanding her as I, you know, became a woman and you know, a mother of teenagers or whatever, and you start to learn that you can forgive them and you can understand where they came from, and
yeah.
you can love them in your own way, and that's okay.
And yeah, I think that's exactly why it took this long. I mean, I'm in my 40s
yeah.
now, and I have a teenage son and a preteen, and I think it really took me to get to this point to realize that, you know, first of all, she is telling the truth to me at this point, and that it was probably really hard for her. And reading the book was probably incredibly difficult. To read a book about, you know, a trauma that your child
yeah.
went through would just be really painful to read.
Did she believe you?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you have siblings? I can't remember.
I have one sister.
Mm-hmm. A sister, that's right. And did she experience childhood as you did? Does she feel the same kinds of things?
Yeah, the lack of love with the family, yes,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. She was very fortunate that she didn't have any physical or sexual abuse happen to her.
Mm-hmm.
But inside the family, there's certainly emotional abuse from neglect.
Yeah, it's very sad. You know, it's interesting. My son said something to me today. My kids don't live with me anymore, but he was here and he was talking to me about early childhood. He says, you know, it's really a shame that I don't remember all the things that you did for me when I was really young, because I remember, you know, you being away in the hospital. I remember those kinds of things. But when you are young, you don't know the sacrifices your parents make for you.
Yeah, you don't.
And I said, you wouldn't believe the stuff I did.
You know? Let me tell them to you.
You'll never know until you're there.
Yeah, funny. It's so true.
It is true. I like the idea that you talk about having courageous conversations. I talk about coaching as having transformational conversations, and I think courageous conversations are conversations like we're having now, and,
mm-hmm.
and the kind that brought you, you know, to speak about the abuse and to other women and people who have had to overcome trauma or are trying to overcome it right now. It's you know, we've talked about how important it is, and it is really important. Now, you have a little picture on your website, and it says, little blurb by it goes, stop lying to yourself. It keeps
mm-hmm.
you from growing and becoming who you were meant to be. What do you mean by that? Stop lying to yourself.
It can come across in so many different ways, and we do it to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you've had trauma, it's so easy to ignore things that are going on inside of you. And so the first thing that I want to tell people, if they are going through that, maybe the trauma is in their past and they're living their life, but they're not living their dreams.
Okay.
And one of the things that can happen is you haven't had that courageous conversation with yourself. Okay? You
mm-hmm.
haven't had that real brave conversation with yourself, and you're still kind of lying to yourself about who you are and what your future can hold for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of like some people call it the gremlins that are in your head,
yeah.
or the gremlins that tell you these horrible things. But
yeah.
you can listen to them. If you listen too strongly to them, you can listen to those lies and start and believe those lies.
Yeah, yeah. And that's just not for just that's for everybody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
I call them members of the board. And they,
all the naysayers in your head, yeah.
Yeah, all the naysayers, they're there, and they're there to tell you all the bad stuff and the good stuff about you. But it's a choice. You have the choice to believe it or not. And
yeah.
That's one of the things I think is really important, is to ask yourself, you know, do I believe this? Is it true?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it true for me?
And sometimes you can ask yourself that and you really truly do believe the lie.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important to have other people in your life, because it's so hard to see ourselves unless we see ourselves through some other people's eyes. Now, I'm not talking about real negative people. You need to be around positive people.
Yeah.
You need to be around good influences when you're asking these kinds of questions. But,
you know, one of the things when I was in a really low state that I did, and I would encourage other people to do this, it's kind of a 360 review of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But you take SurveyMonkey, which is a free program on the Internet, And you send it out to a whole bunch of people that you know, friends and acquaintances, and you ask them to give you three words that they believe describe you. And what becomes really interesting is that a lot of people send back the same words.
Oh,
and
great.
Even if you
love
can't
that.
See yourself, you know, a certain way, they do. They see you as being strong or independent or brave or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
it could be. And you might be amazed at,
yeah.
at what they have to say about you.
And
it can be
you
really
have to be careful to make sure that you listen when you get them back. Because,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
That's what I'm talking about sometimes we lie to ourselves,
yep.
where
yeah.
Somebody can say something as simple as, wow, your hair looks great today. And we're
mm-hmm.
thinking, well, our hair looks horrible today. I know. I looked in the mirror this morning. So,
yeah.
But if five people tell you your hair looks great, you need
yeah.
to listen to that person. That's a very silly, simple example. But
no,
if
but
all
it's
of these people are telling you, yeah.
That inner voice, if that inner voice comes back with, I look horrible, then you know
yeah.
it's an ego talking and you know it's not your true self because you would never give yourself anything but a loving message. So you could ignore the negative ones.
Right.
Just pop those out and go, no, you know what, that one's lying to me because it's not positive. So
right.
I think that's you know, a test for people. It's kind of like the barometer. If it's negative and it says, you know, you're ugly and you're stupid and you'll never amount to anything, then that's not That's one of the board members that you can get rid of. You don't
right.
need that one.
Well,
yeah.
I love your idea of sending out the Survey Monkey. I think that's fabulous.
Well, and it's anonymous for them, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they really don't have to say nice things because they're not going to, I wouldn't know, you wouldn't know who's
right.
saying it anyway. Yeah. The you were talking about people who kind of coast through life, but they don't actually enjoy it. There's no passion and real, you know,
yeah.
real love, let's say, for their life in their life. In 2008, you attended an event. I think that changed your life in some ways. It was a speaking
yeah.
of women's health, and
mm-hmm.
one of the keynotes was Rhonda Britton. Would you say that she was a catalyst for change in your life?
Oh, huge. Yeah, absolutely huge. And
what was she talking about?
Well, she was actually telling her story. There were three keynotes that day, and she's the only one I can remember the name of.
yeah.
They were all good. They were all really good. But Rhonda got up and got us very, very excited. We were listening to her, and she was just, she had us all in the palm of her hand. It was just wonderful. She was very vibrant and vivacious and exciting. And she then said that I have not always been this way. And she started telling her story. And you can tell the story real quick?
Mm-hmm. Oh, please.
So,
yeah.
So she's telling this story about when she was a kid. And I believe she was a teenager. And her mother had just made her this white dress, had hand-sewn a white dress for her because she was going to a dance that night. Her father and mother were estranged. I don't recall if they were divorced or not, but I know they weren't living together. And they were sitting, the mother and the daughter, Rhonda, were sitting on the front porch when the father drives up and pulls up in his car. He gets out of his car holding a shotgun.
Oh my
and he
God.
Starts yelling at Rhonda and the mother sitting on the front porch. He starts yelling and saying, if I can't have you, no one can have you. Well, the mother starts walking down towards him, trying to calm him down, and he shoots her.
Oh, my God.
So she's still alive, and she starts screaming at him, don't hurt Rhonda, don't hurt Rhonda. She's getting closer and closer to the car, and when she gets next to the car where he still is, he shoots her again.
Oh,
he falls into the car and lands on the horn. So the horn's still going. He's walking towards Rhonda. Now she is standing on the porch, and she's just watched her mother get murdered.
Yeah.
And he comes closer and closer, the gun pointed at her, and she's thinking she's going to die.
How old was she?
She was a teen. I don't recall exactly how old she was, but she was a teenager.
Okay.
And he comes up the steps and gets down on his knees, puts the gun down the ground, puts his head against the butt of the gun, and shoots himself. So, of course, all over her white dress. And she's
yeah.
just standing there, having witnessed this brutal murder of her mother and her father killing
her.
Yeah. So, you know, horrible. What tragedy. Now, but here's what happened. She blamed herself. Why didn't I do anything? Why didn't I stop it? I mean, that's what happens when you're a kid and something like this happens. Why didn't I stop? Why didn't I run down? Why I should have been able to stop him? So she had this incredible spiral downward, self-blame, doubt, just horrible, complete victim mentality. And eventually she was able to pull herself out of it. Well, while I was listening to this story, it struck me that, oh my gosh, I have a story that can change women's lives. Because for what I've gone through with the rapes and the sexual abuse and having gone through a psychiatric institution where I was basically told, you know, you're going to be on drugs for the rest of your life, even though, you know, I refused drugs while I was there, I had been told, you know, you need drugs for you to be better. And I was never going to have this great life. And yet I do. You know, I'm married. Mm-hmm. I have two beautiful kids. I have a wonderful business. I speak. I have a radio show. I've written a book. I have two more on the way. I have an amazing life. I love my life. And it clicked in me that I can help women too. But then I immediately got scared, and I thought, oh, my gosh, that means I have to tell people.
That means
I have to tell people. How do I do that? And that I was really scared, really scared. But, yeah, it absolutely changed my life listening
to
Ron.
Who knew your story at that point? Did your husband know the story?
Yeah, my husband, my closest friends, and my family, they all knew. But
how
outside
were
of that,
you
no.
able to fall in love with the right guy?
Wow.
And I ask that for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, oftentimes when you understand the idea of vibration and attracting, you know, the right or the wrong person, depending where your headspace is at. But first of all, you manage to find love. You manage to allow someone to love you. Mm-hmm. And you found the right guy. How did you do that? How are you so smart?
It wasn't my first choice.
Yeah.
I made a lot of mistakes beforehand. I mean, a lot of mistakes. People I thought I was in love with, and very, very codependent, horrible relationships. I was engaged at one point to a guy that was a drug addict, and I was too. So, you know, that was just a mess. I had been engaged once before to a guy that cheated on me. I made a lot of mistakes. A lot of mistakes. And I had at one point completely sworn off relationships. I decided I was never, ever going to get married. I was never, ever, ever, absolutely never going to have children. It just wasn't worth it. I thought, you know what, I can please myself. I just don't need to be in a relationship with anybody. I don't need it.
And how old were you when you met him?
When I met my husband, I was 27.
Okay, and what was going on in your life at the time?
Well, a lot of healing. I had gotten out of all those relationships. I had still decided I was not going to be in a relationship with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I had made up some rules for myself about dating. And
okay.
I was not going on a date unless it was a double date. Just a safety precaution. Made me feel really good and safe and secure. And it's really interesting the things you learn about people by going on double dates. It's really,
oh, really?
Really interesting. So only went on double dates. My date was always going to open my door for me and pay for dinner. And I had these rules. And it was so freeing and comfortable, and I was able to relax because there was no holding hands. There was no kissing at the door because I was going on double dates.
Right, right.
So it was so freeing, and I was actually able to go on a date and just relax and get to know the person.
So when you went on this double date, was it an arranged date then, or did he ask you out and you said, well, let's go out with other people? How did it happen?
He asked me out, and we went on a date with another couple. It was two couples. We went out, and it was with one of my roommates. And
okay. Were you at school?
Her boyfriend.
No, you wouldn't have been at school at this point.
No, I was living in San Diego. I can't remember what job I had at the time, but I was living in San Diego.
Yeah.
And it's very expensive in San Diego, so I had several roommates. Yeah. But one of my roommates and her boyfriend went on a double date with us. And it was a great date. It was just a great date. We went out to dinner. We had so many things in common.
How did you meet him?
I met him at church, actually.
Oh, okay.
The church I was going to.
And so this was somebody who was, like, probably more straight than you were used to, or?
At the time, I had decided I was only going to date guys in my church. I was just...
Oh, okay.
That was the only people I was going to date, was people in my church. I just felt more comfortable. So that's how I met, was at church in a singles group. We ended up dating, and that date, and I had dated lots of guys in church, and just, I mean, they were nice, and it was fun, but absolutely no interest. I dated Sean, and at the end of the night, I remember going to a swimming pool with my girlfriend, who had been on a date with me, and she said, so what'd you think? And I said, you know, I think I can marry him.
Oh, wow.
We both looked at each other, and she said, what? She said, you're not marrying anybody. And I said, I know. And she said, but you just went on your first date. And I said, I know. I said, I didn't say I would marry him, but I really think this guy could change my mind.
Huh.
And he did.
And he did. Fantastic.
When he asked me to marry him, just to give you an idea, when he asked me to marry him, he took me to a gazebo on La Jolla Shores, on a double date, by the way. We went to La Jolla Shores.
I know the place.
And he brought a boom box, put the boom box down on a bench, sat me down, got down on his knees, and he sang Unforgettable.
Oh, wow, how romantic.
And then asked me to marry him. And, of course, I just said yes. And then we went out back out to his car, and he pulled out a dozen long-stem red roses and then took me to dinner and then to an engagement party where all of my family, his family, and our friends were waiting for us.
So this is beautiful, and it's very romantic.
It was amazing.
But you know, if we look back at your mom today and how she reacted to the story, oftentimes we feel that the people in our lives are reflections of us. And so when your story came out publicly in this book, did he have any problems with it, with people knowing what happened to you?
My husband?
Yeah.
No. Mm-mm. No. And I think it's because he knew and knows how important it is to me, and he believes in what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. So, no, and he's very proud of who I am.
And what about your kids? How do they handle this?
They know that I've written the book. They know a little bit about my history. They don't know specifically. They know that I've, you know, they're still fairly young. They'll know probably a lot more of the story in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
But they are 13 and 11. So.
Okay, so they're still young, fairly
young.
Yeah,
there's still some things I'm trying to, you know, kind of keeping away from them. But they do know that there was some abuse, and they do know that I was raped. They understand what that means. But they don't
boys?
Know.
Are your children boys? Or?
Yes, they're both boys.
Okay.
They're both boys. But, yeah, so there's some parts of the story they don't know.
We are speaking with Deirdre Huey, and her book is called I Am Bound and Determined, and I know that you can find this on Amazon.com. Yes. I imagine you can find it at Barnes & Noble as well. And where else can we find this amazing book?
On my website, the easiest way to get to that is just to go to imboundanddetermined.com.
Okay, excellent. Now, you know, I just want to say that I say that this is an amazing book, and I believe that it is an amazing book because when Deirdre, after I read it and you asked me if I would write a little something, a testimony for your book, for your site, I did so, and I wanted to share that with folks, but I need to find it. So where did I put that? Because I want you guys to know that I do walk my talk. I'm not just spouting out of the side of my mouth here.
Well, if you can't find it, I have it.
I think I just found it. Okay. I think I said, when you are ready to see your destiny change, to be the captain of your life, give yourself an hour or two to read Deirdre Huey's I Am Bound and Determined, an inspirational book of resilient life stories, including her own, that will have you weeping, raging, and cheering for every victory and happiness found and won. And if you're fortunate enough to pick up this gem of a book, I can guarantee that it will alter your life, change your thinking, or give you the courage to try something new. And I think that is exactly what you were hoping for, that people will pick up this book and change their thinking and have the courage to find, you know, to try something new.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was so deeply appreciative when I read that, because that is exactly what I want to do, is help to give people hope so that they can move forward, make some positive, great changes in their life, and that this book can hopefully be a catalyst for them.
Give us a little bit about how you found these women and how you chose them or culled through you know, them and decided to put. I know that you said that, you know, they'd all gone through a trauma and that they had survived.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, going through this book and reading their stories and incredible stories, really, of survival, how did you find them and say, okay, did it matter how many stories you had in your book or?
No, it didn't. I didn't want there to be, you know, 100 stories,
right.
But I really didn't have a number in mind.
Okay.
I really didn't know how many people were going to respond to my request. So I used a service called Haro, helpareporterout.com by Peter Shankman,
mm-hmm.
and sent the request out looking for women that have had trauma but are successful. And within 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, I had over 60 women respond. And at that point, I sent out a questionnaire to every single person that responded and asked them to answer the questions. Now, at this point, I thought to myself, wow, if 10 people respond
mm-hmm.
to these questionnaires, I'll be really ecstatic, because some of the questions were really tough. And some of them were very encouraging and hopeful, because I wanted to know what their favorite quotes were and their favorite mantras and what they do now and, you know, all of these positive things. But I also asked them very serious questions about what they went through and how it felt and what it did to them psychologically. So I knew that I wouldn't get them all back. But what I was really surprised about is that I got over 35 questionnaires back.
Wow. That is huge.
Which really, really surprised me. So at that point, what I did was I waited 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
And after a month was up, then I sent the request back for releases for the information. See, at that
mm-hmm.
point, I still didn't have permission to use the stories. I just had the stories.
Yeah.
But I truly wanted to wait, because I was sure that some women would change their minds. And they did. And I completely respect that they changed their mind. And at that point, I also asked them, can I use your full name? If I can't use your full name, can I use your first name? If not, can I use an alias? And what was really surprising to me is I ended up getting all but two that said, yes, please use my entire name. You are more than welcome.
You know what's amazing is that so many of these women are doctors.
Yeah.
Or doctorates. And
yeah.
And very successful.
Yeah. Yeah, there are several that are millionaires. I mean, you know, and everybody has their own definition of success.
Yeah, yeah. But just the fact that, you know, they were able to share the story. And you know, one, I think one or two that really come to mind is Shirley.
Oh, Shirley Chang.
Yeah. Can you tell a bit about her story?
Yeah, Shirley Chang, well, it's absolutely fascinating what she does now, because she's a international advocate for the blind, which is absolutely amazing. But she had, oh my gosh, her story was just absolutely amazing. She had severe juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, incredible pain. She had... Her mother had taken her to China to get treatment because she had constant pain from the arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And when she came back to, before then, when she was in America, her mother had to fight a custody case to be able to keep her, and for some reason a doctor tricked the judge and lost her mother for a little while. So it was just on and on and on, these horrible things that happened to her. She was very ill, she was sick, she had a people that left her, she was losing her eyesight, and people just would leave her and abandon her in the middle of a school. Just leave her, and she had no
unbelievable.
She lost her eyesight when she was 17.
Yeah, I really feel for sure. You know, we got a caller. Hang on here. Let's see. Hi, Erico 302. Good evening.
Hi there. This is Debbie Apocalypse Sharp. Hi, Frankie. Hi, Deidre.
Hi, Debbie.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. I've been listening, and I've enjoyed Deidre. I'm anxious to go out and get your book. We have a lot of things in common.
Do you know Debbie,
being on the show.
Deidre?
No.
Mm-mm. Oh, okay. Debbie is the author of Shattered, Reclaiming a Life Torn Apart by Violence. And
oh,
she was
wow.
a guest, I think, a year or two ago. Herself, an incredible story, a traumatic event. Maybe you want to just give her a brief history real quick.
Oh, my. Well, it's pretty difficult, but very quickly, 12 years ago, I was the victim of a violent crime where my husband was murdered, and the man who murdered my husband kidnapped me and held me hostage for 5 days and raped me repeatedly.
Oh, my
and
God.
But I just wanted to thank you, because as you, I am also an author and an inspirational speaker, and I agree with so much that you've said tonight about hope, because without hope, it's part of something that a victim really needs to hang on to, and I also agree that, you know, we need to have people to help us along the journey, like yourself. I had a wonderful counselor who, you know, encouraged me, gave me the tools to survive, and like yourself, I also, you know, found a person. I'm remarried and have a very supportive husband who understands the work that I need to do to reach out to other people who have been victimized.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. In a nutshell.
There's, you know, I'm just so amazed by you wonderfully courageous women. I'm just so thrilled, Debbie, that you were able to listen in tonight to Deirdre, and that it struck a chord with you.
It's
great.
Yes, definitely. I just, like I said, Deirdre, I just really understand, and all the messages that you've given tonight are so significant. And I also read online, you know, you almost say the same thing that I do. There is life after trauma. And, you know, having that hope and having that faith in yourself to just, mine is all about reclamation, reclaiming my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wrote about. But I think it's important for us, like you said, to talk. And this is what we're doing. It's important, you know, just to talk to one another and to encourage others to talk, because I know as I speak, I don't know about you, Deirdre, but as I talk across the nation, I have victims that actually approach me and disclose, sometimes for the first time.
Yeah.
And it's, oh my goodness, it's so empowering for me to be able to say to that person, well, you're not alone, and then I encourage them, of course, to get the help that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's
have
really
you met, have you
amazing.
Met, I'm just wondering if you've met the women in your book, Deirdre? Have you ever, all of you decided, hey, let's get together and...
You know, we have talked about it, but I have met several of them, but not all of them. I have,
and Deirdre,
I have met,
you,
several.
You, don't you do seminars now for trauma? Or with,
well,
with...
I actually, it depends. I have different seminars. They vary. Now, with my book, it's actually required reading for victimology, so I go to some universities and speak to criminal justice students. And then I also am invited to go to conferences for victim service providers, depending on their venue. So, and law enforcement, I do a lot of law enforcement training, so it varies.
But is there a conference for leaders like yourselves who speak about trauma to others? Have you guys ever gotten together?
I've heard of one that's in Texas. There's a big conference that's for trauma survivors in Texas that's held once a year, but I have not been to it yet.
Neither have I. No, I've been to Texas several times, but the conferences have been usually through the prosecutor's office. And it's usually for victim service providers.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Deborah, for calling in. We've got just 3 minutes remaining. I don't know if you have any words of wisdom that you'd like to depart before I get back to Deirdre and what she'd like to end her show with. But
actually, I'd like to give her the time. This is her show, but it was such a pleasure speaking with you both, and just continue what you're doing, and it was so nice to meet you, and I look forward to getting your book. So God bless.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Deborah, for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Great
Bye-bye.
To hear your voice again. Bye-bye.
Great
Bye.
To hear yours. Goodbye.
So many stories. Everybody
wow.
has a story. Amanda Marshall's song, right? Everybody has a story.
Wow. That's awesome.
Hmm. Yeah.
Incredible
yeah.
story. Holy cow.
I have to say, you know, the most chilling we had her 911 call. It was extremely chilling, to say the least. Hopefully, you know, you guys can get together. It'd be great.
Yeah, I would love to
share your stories again with one another. So, Deirdre, sorry,
Deirdre. <That's okay.
laughs> I used to want to be called Deirdre when I was a little girl.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I love the fact you call yourself Unstoppable Frankie Parasso. I just love it.
Oh, thank you. Well, you got to be unstoppable.
Absolutely.
For sure. And, you know, it's interesting because I was recently at a doctor. He goes, your head is so hard, but your body's not catching up. And I went, oh, maybe I shouldn't call myself unstoppable. Maybe that's wrong. It went into my subconscious and it won't stop. But, you know, why not give yourself a nickname? And, you know, we talk about the messages that we give ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one way to reinforce as a mantra, whatever, to give yourself the hope and health that you need. So, you know, you can pick something like that and just call yourself, you're the hopeologist.
Right.
You know, you give out hope to people. And as Deborah just said, too, it's really important to know that there's hope. Now, one of the things, I met somebody before who was in a really tragic accident, and one of his things was that St. Francis of Assisi had said, where there's despair, there's hope.
Hmm.
So never give up, because even in your darkest moments, there's always hope. There's always hope.
Absolutely.
I believe that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do we want to tell these women, men? I mean, they go through it too.
Sure.
I know that you work with women, you know, specifically. Now, are you on medication to look after the bipolar?
No.
Did that go away, or was it a misdiagnosis, or what happened?
No. They're actually not exactly sure. The medicine was prescribed or advised while I was in the hospital. My personal therapist, psychologist, said that if I thought that I didn't need it, that I could refuse it because I was self-committed. And so I refused it and never did take it. I'm sure it took me longer to move past the depression as a result, but I have never taken medication for it.
Wow. Okay, well, we've got like 20 seconds here. So give us your last words of wisdom, Deirdre.
I think all that we've talked about is certainly true. Have hope and forgiveness. But I like to end on these three things, which is in order to move forward, you have to let go of the past. You have to let that go, find a way to let it go. And then you have to let go of your fears, because trauma is can leave so many fears inside of you where you won't jump in and do anything in your life. And then you have to let go of why. Because if you get stuck in why did this happen, you still will not move forward. So you have to let go. And it'll be wonderful to see what happens in your life. So let go and see.
Thank you so much for being my guest this evening. You really inspired me. I have to say that. And I'm sure that you have inspired everybody that is listening to you to go out and find a little bit of hope for themselves. Because, as you said, you know, I say the past is not your potential, and I think that you're living proof of that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show today, Frankie. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. And bless all of you who have been listening, and I do hope that you will be back with me again next week as we have a flight plan. And it's Bruxton Bradley, I think is his name. And we'll be talking about how to teach our men or our boys to become men. Anyway, should be interesting. We'll see you next week. Thanks, and we'll see you then. That's all I can say. Goodbye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Houston. For a limited time at VisionWorks, you can get two complete pairs of glasses. Frames, lenses, the works, for just $49 on single vision glasses and $89 on progressives. And that's a good deal. But we offer that pricing on over 500 frames, which makes it a great deal. Right now, buy two complete pairs of single vision glasses for just $49 or two pairs of progressives for only $89. VisionWorks, we're here to help you. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer expires November 10th. Hey, Houston. For a limited time at VisionWorks, you can get two complete pairs of glasses. Frames, lenses, the works, for just $49 on single vision glasses and $89 on progressives. And that's a good deal. But we offer that pricing on over 500 frames, which makes it a great deal. Right now, buy two complete pairs of single vision glasses for just $49 or two pairs of progressives for only $89. VisionWorks, we're here to help you. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. Offer expires November 10th.